The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. For the third time, it's Ann Sperling. For the second time, it is Peter Gamble, and I am at Daubin Estate here in Niagara, but it doesn't feel like I'm in Niagara. Let's just start here. First off, guys, thanks so much for doing this. I can't wait to hear all about another one of the crazy projects that you guys are doing, but how different is where we are right now versus when you drive down a small gravel driveway?
This is a really amazing site, and it's an interesting story in the background. Now, let me get to it, because it gives you a sense and paints a bit of a picture. So I get a phone call from Wade Daubin, and it's a cold call. Wade says, "Hey, I want to start a winery in Niagara. I want to do something top end. I bought some land. I don't know for sure whether I just make something for friends or whether it's a great, you know, piece of land, but I've been told I should give you a call. You know, my friends are the Westcotts from Westcott Winery."
Of course. And, when was this, by the way?
They'd given some guidance. This would be back in 19 or late 18, thereabouts. So I says, "Well, what do you got?" And he says, "Well, I got a north-facing slope and a south-facing slope. And it's on the bench, and it's got a 7-acre lake in the middle of it." Right? And I said, "Oh, you bought the Laura Sabrin property, right?" And he's like blown away. He said, "Really? You know?" And I said, "Well, it's the only thing like that in all of Niagara. I mean, it can only be that, right?" And the south-facing slopes are really unusual here, and they provide some interesting advantages from a winemaking point of view. So that's sort of the background. He said, well, what do you think of it?" And I said, "Well, it's hard to say. It's never really been pushed from a viticultural point of view. Laura did quite a few things with, you know, gardening and markets and that sort of thing and black currants. But there's definitely a lot of vines on it and some that we'd need to change. But I think it could have good potential. We'll need to look at it." But I said, "Ann, and I know the site really well, and it's gorgeous, right?" I said, "It could be Blenheim." And he broke out laughing. And he said, "You know," he says, "Faye and I have seen more formal gardens in the world than we have wineries. That's what we want to do." So he says, "We want to add a vineyard component to a really top-end, garden approach." And so that's the background. So I'll give you very much a sense of, just what we're sitting on here.
I want to talk more about that with Wade. Also, though, I want to give everyone because it's a podcast, is you drive down this gravel road, and you don't expect much. And the area around, you can't see it. And then you come around a corner, and there's all these beautifully manicured vineyards. And then there's this beautiful tower where I feel like I'm somewhere in the middle of France, like this small tower, you know, there's a little island and there's a little lake, and I couldn't help but feel, where the hell am I? Yeah. It felt so different than like 16 Miles Cellar, which isn't far from here, and they do great work. Okay, but let me ask you this. So you guys, how long did you guys know about this property? I find this hilarious that you knew about it, and it's almost like in the movie Jaws, because I was watching the other day, where the shark is surrounding the orca, the boat. It feels like you guys are Jaws, and this property is the boat. Like, you've known about this. Like, it's almost like you've wanted to get your hands on this property for a while.
Oh, absolutely. And working with Laura over the years, she was the first biodynamic vineyard in the region and, you know, probably in Canada. The vines and the land has been worked organically for over 25 years. We've also, I had made some really interesting wines from the property in the past. So this was a cool opportunity. The real interest came when we did our soil pits, which is we dig down like at least 2 meters and we actually go into this little subterranean hole that we make and we look at the soil profile. We also do, you know, testing, soil testing and that sort of thing all the way down. But what was really unbelievable was the reaction, the reaction that we got when we tested for calcium carbonate.
And what did you get? What was the reaction? And I know this might get a little technical, but, you know, with you guys, I think you guys, this is the kind of stuff people that are listening would love to learn about.
So in the past, in the bench area particularly, and also at Southbrook, we did some research with a famous French soil guy, Yves Harity. He was invited here by a group of winemakers, all the names, all the best names in winemaking in the region, so Hidden Bench and Malavoie and Le Clos Jardin, and the list goes on.
Batchelder.
Yeah. And so we all work together to understand our soils better. And he's got a test, very simple test. It's basically you see how you apply a weak solution of sulfuric acid, and you see it reacting. So it fizzes, basically, if there's any calcium carbonate there.
Yeah.
And throughout the bench and throughout the region, we got little kind of glimpses of this calcium carbonate component in the soils, but nothing that was really mind-blowing. So when we went into the pits around this property, it was 100% reaction in the strongest way in every single pit from top to bottom. So we were like, could this be right? Like, let's check our solutions, let's check, you know, everything. And we redid it and we found the same thing. What that means is that we've got a soil that's unique to the region, but we also have the climate and, you know, the physical properties of the soil that we're totally familiar with.
Yeah, the cool background on that, Matt, is that, you know, catching up with sort of the works of the monks, you know, 500 years ago in
right.
Burgundy, when they determined where the Grand Cru properties were in Burgundy. Years later, it became obvious that the best of the sites were located where the limestone was really prominent. And the same thing happened with regard to the selection of the Grand Cru villages in Champagne, and there it's chalk. And as science sort of caught up, it was essentially the calcium carbonate contributions and their effect on the roots of the vines that created the greater sites in there. So the presence of that is really important, you know, acknowledged over sort of centuries as it relates to that. So it was absolutely great to, you know, to find it here. You know, the follow-up on that and is that, you know, a phone call with Wade on, you know, there's good news and there's bad news. You know, the good news is this is a really fabulous site. Like, you know, and we told him that story in the Grand Cru, you know, basin and everything and said, so what's the bad news? Well, the bad news is, you know, we really only like about 3 acres out of the 18 that we planted. We need to redo it. And you got an obligation. Like, this is a really serious piece of land. If Ann and I are going to be involved, we'd want to have carte blanche. We want to be able to do tight plantings. We're going to need to see irrigation. We're going to need to see, you know, drainage. We're going to need to see, you know, a lot of things, the specialized clones to match the calcium carbonate soils and really be able to pull out all the stops. But, you know, it's a tremendous opportunity and it could have some impact on the genre locally. It's an interesting chance. And so, so Wade and Nathan were both game and said, let's do it. Let's see how much we can do.
Well, let's introduce the third member here, Nathan Dobbin. Nathan, thank you so much also for being a part of this and allowing me a glimpse into this beautiful site. I was wondering just if you could give people a little more background into Dobbin and sort of the genesis from the beginning.
As Peter was saying, and Ann, it was that we wanted to start something that was, I mean, really wanted to start something that was cool, something that expanded past the vineyard. We're big on contemplative ideas, so that, you know, we believe that wine is something you enjoy with life to expand your experiences, much like literature or cuisine, things like that. So when we want to do this, we want to do something that you could enjoy with the wine, hence the gardens, the property itself, not necessarily something opulent, something that was intriguing, something that as you turned a corner you'd find something else and you could keep exploring it. It really came down to, we discovered that it was an opportunity to do something in Niagara. Once we realized what we had here, it became almost more of an obligation. We said, okay, we can do something cool here. I mean, it really aligned with the fact that it's a small vineyard, so that with the 17 acres you could do something that you could keep your eyes and your hands on constantly. The organic was huge for us as well. It's not something we necessarily market. It's something that we believe in, that, you know, helps us represent the terroir in the wines. I don't think you could do what we do here if it were any bigger than 17 acres, just with the amount of meticulous work it takes and being able to react to the season every year. So really everything we got here was just incredibly fortunate for us to have it all aligned, and then having Peter and Ann come on board as well to guide us through it.
I want to hit on the word you said, obligation, but real quick, how many years, how many vintages? Like, when was the first year you guys really started to plant, and when was your first release?
Well, we planted in 19, our first, the North Block right behind us here, which is the Pinot Noir. And that was some pretty carefully selected clones and rootstock to work in Niagara. We sourced it from Washington, as opposed to locally, to get the clones that Peter and Ann, I almost said we, but really it's Peter and Ann, felt we're going to work the best with the climate here. And then in 20, we planted our South Block in its entirety, which is our Chardonnay, Riesling, Cab Franc, and Pinot again. So the first vintage we pulled from our new plantings was the 22, which is a Pinot Noir, but we did make vintages from our existing West Block over there, which is Chardonnay and Riesling, in 2019, which was big because, and Peter will happily go into this later, but the Riesling was something that Peter really pushed on us. He had a vision that the Riesling, mainly due to its price point, I suppose, in Niagara, had never been done at the levels it was being done, in Germany, which included multiple picks and micro fermentations and to get you to where you could blend it, mm-hmm. to have such a layered, complex wine. So 19 was our first go, and you're going to taste that a little bit later, the 19 Riesling, which we're really proud of, because it's easy for me to brag about it because I didn't do it. So Peter and Ann knocked it out of the park.
11 minutes and 30 seconds, the first mention of Riesling on the pod, or German Riesling, which usually is around the time for someone in my podcast when someone mentions Riesling. It's almost a staple. By the way, there's food that's been planted. There's in front of me. There's wine in front of me that's exciting, but I did want to circle back. You said you felt an obligation. What was it about this property, about your family, about here, where you felt an obligation? Because making wine it's hard.
I mean, it goes back to growing up in Niagara. So, I mean, growing up here, we were always aware that there was always rumblings that Niagara could be a premium location for winemaking. And then, you can never really find it. I mean, back in the 80s and early 90s. When I was a kid, you'd hear about it, but it was hard to find proof of it. Then, all these other wineries started to make wine that was starting to show that. And they did a lot of the hard work, I mean, with Peter and Ann involved too, and people like Thomas Batchelder and everyone else and all the other wineries that really slugged it out and did it at lower price points. But it was a chance for us to do something in Niagara that we always wanted to see ourselves. Peter and Ann were a big part of that because their excitement in it, especially back in 2019, because things have changed a lot in the last 5 years in Niagara already since we've been involved. But back in 2019, there was still a lot of, that's crazy that you would try to do an elevated product in Niagara. Once we knew what we had here, we were really excited to be able to do it. And we did feel a bit of an obligation to not let all these qualities of the property go to waste, for lack of better words.
Yeah,
we knew what we had. We stumbled on an incredible gem. It was, I mean, and thanks partly, it was Laura Sabrin who guarded it in her own way and kept it off the radar, kind of. And we just happened to be in the right place at the right time when she was looking to sell. And fortunate to get it.
What should be the first pairing that we want to do here? And yes, there's one more. I'm sorry. This is the first time I've had four people, and this is going to be like one of these podcasts. I feel like Sally, Jesse, Raphael, when you go into the crowd. That's a really old reference. Half the people aren't, or Phil Donahue, where you go into the crowd. David, I was wondering if you could introduce yourself to the pod.
My name is Dave Brennan. I'm the assistant winemaker here. I have a part-time duty putting together the tasting pairings that are prepared by our chef Laura Ramick. So the first one we're going to be going through, paired with the Chardonnay, is a wild mushroom vol-au-vent pastry with some walnut crumble in there as well. The second pairing we're going to do with the Cab is going to be a flour tortilla with miso eggplant, a white bean spread, and a little gremolata on top of that. Third, with the first Riesling we're going to taste, is a sesame pancake with five spice apple slices, duck prosciutto, and just some microgreens on there. Mm-hmm. And then finally, with the last Riesling we're gonna do, it's gonna be a phyllo puff pastry with pear and chèvre cheese.
This is a much better breakfast than what I am normally used to. We can put the mics down. We'll try the first one, and then we'll pick it up, and we'll chat about the wine and the food. So just have a quick bite. And we're back. This mushroom pastry dish, I don't know if I'd call it a dish, incredible with the 2019 Chardonnay. I mean, just the richness of the mushrooms. I think a little cream in there. This is a perfect combination. Peter, you know, let's start on the wine. What do we need to know about the 2019 Daubin Chardonnay? And to David and to the chefs, I mean, just incredible.
Yeah, so 2019, wonderful year for Chardonnay in Niagara. I love the 19. It's a little bit cooler. Classically bracing acidity, really close to white Burgundy, and it allows those of us that use white Burgundy, great white Burgundy, as a paradigm for Chardonnay, a really good opportunity in a year like 19. It's a year that, you know, even Burgundy would get less frequently now with you know, the increases in temperature. And so very classically structured, great acidities, meant for long aging. Ageability is a fundamental part of what we do here. Nathan and Wade have totally bought into the concept of making wines extremely naturally. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is that winemakers often, in order to make wines more accessible, you know, so you can actually release, you know, whatever, in this case, maybe a 2023 red early and have it on the shelves and have it less expensive. Winemakers actually go through, you know, filtrations and refinings, a number of different treatments on the wine in order to make it ready sooner. But when you're making classically structured wines and you want them to retain all of their flavor, all of their intensity, all of their balance, then the winemaking is really much, much more natural. You want to let things fall brilliant by themselves in terms of clarifications and, you know, just make wines that really will stand up to age.
Here's what I love about this wine, because I'm a Chardonnay freak. Sometimes when you get notes like butterscotch, you're worried. Is it just big and sugary? And is it just something created for the masses by adding a lot of chemicals and things like that? You get that depth. You get that butterscotch. You get these richness to it. You have the word nutmeg, but then you said the bracing. The acidity is there. Like this is a serious Chardonnay. And if I'm just going to do this in a very lame and dumb way to describe it, this is serious, but it's also fun. It has this big, beautiful, rich fruit notes and spice notes and the butterscotch, but with all the structure around it that you take a sip and you realize, I'm not drinking a normal sort of Chardonnay. That wine there's got everything to it. Again, I'm biased. I'm a Chardonnay freak. That one is fantastic.
Great. Thank you.
Well, okay. Well, I have you. Before we get on the second wine, I'll throw it back to Nathan as well, a little bit about Wade, about the owner. And really what I'm curious about, and this is sort of a Peter and Ann question, but you guys can answer it as well, is it feels like Peter and Ann, you throw out the bat signal when it's like, okay, we have a serious project. We need serious people to do it. And there's a couple that are out there. And, you know, like Thomas Batchelder is one of them. You know, I interviewed you guys for another wine project. And it felt like when someone in the Niagara area has a great piece of property with south-facing vineyards, it's like, throw out the bat sign, give us Peter and Ann.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the case. It also, I think it took us a little while to even understand what we had with Peter and Ann. You know, we were told they were the people to call. It wasn't until we went through what the vineyard had and we got an idea of what they were capable of and what they saw. And I mean, the thing is with what we're doing here was, I think it's fair to say it's the first time that Peter and Anne were let off the leash to some degree. So their excitement was pretty palpable.
Mm-hmm.
So to see them excited, kind of like kids in a candy store, you know, excited us as well. It was really cool. So in tandem, we kind of went on this journey throughout 2019 and early 2020 where we looked at what we were doing. And then with the vintages of 2019 coming out, especially the Riesling, we really saw, no pun intended, the fruits of those labor work out. So when, I mean, we joke about it, but Wade and I, there was a point where we went, I'm glad these wines don't suck.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that they're as good as we said they would be. And then we saw, and then also for us, it was, you know, we were lucky to drink good wines with Wade. I was always a big aficionado of good wines and had the means to buy them. My brother and I got to drink them.
That's always solid.
Fantastic. Yeah. And it let us know the difference between a good wine and a less than quality wine. But we'd never had the chance to watch wine grow from the vineyard to the bottle. And then even from, you know, you rarely get a chance to get an ageable wine in bottle in your hands on the bottling date. So, you know, the Chardonnay is a great example of that where, you know, we're drinking it and we're like, yeah, this is pretty good wine. And then watched it, you know, one day, opened it and drank and said, holy, this is really becoming a spectacular wine. So that was interesting too. So, I mean, I've probably gone pretty far off your question about Peter and Ann, but it was part of being on that journey with them that had us really grow in each step in appreciation as we saw what, you know, they were telling us things. And we're like, all right, sounds like you know what you're talking about. but then as we saw it come into fruition, that was the more exciting part. So we saw the things we were doing and the advice they were giving us work out was the really cool part.
And you guys must have been excited. You mentioned this earlier about getting, you know, we need to have tight, you know, we're going to plan a certain way. We're going to have a certain level of tightness. We're going to need irrigation. You guys were given basically given carte blanche to work. I mean, obviously working with what the philosophy for Dobbin was, but you guys were given carte blanche in terms of the winemaking?
Yeah, absolutely so. And you know, you want to work with people that are philosophically similar, that have similar goals.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, been the case too. And being able to do what we need to do on a property like this was really important to us. Again, it's we're taking on projects at this point where we think that they can have, you know, an impact on the, you know, the industry and try to do things in that regard. And the carte blanche extends to the hiring too. I mean, we did a 7-month hunt, you know, internationally and managed to get Dave on board. And, you know, it's not like there's an awful lot as we commence, you know, with this project. There's, you know, smaller crops in the early years. The winery, you know, as you can see, isn't even fully constructed yet. We have a small partial one that helps us in the early years. The other one will be starting soon, but there's just so much involved. We have the laser bird scares, a lot of things that are, you know, new to the industry in order to help with the total quality and just, you know, a lot of efforts to really make it exciting.
Actually, let's go. I want to go over to David just about the hunt. And so then you're hiring, it's almost like The Bachelor, you know, just but for winemaking. I just wanted to tell people just a little bit about your background and how you got a part of the project here.
So I started out originally at Domaine Kalus with Kelly. So I got to learn under her and Brooke Husband, the assistant there. They were incredibly instrumental in teaching me the ins and outs, especially with regarding to Pinot and Chardonnay production. After that, there was an opportunity I saw posting, and it was for assistant winemaking position here. Obviously, I knew that it was going to be studying under Peter and Ann, so that already kind of lit me up a bit. The second I stepped onto the property, it was just like, this is where I need to be. Like, it's just absolutely incredible. And the team here, Nathan, Garrett, Wade, the owner, are just absolutely top shelf people. So it was a no-brainer to pursue it, and I couldn't be happier that I'm here right now.
The connection of all of it, you know, just it feels like there is a wine mafia of the top just influenced and winemakers. You know, you got everyone in this room here, and then Batchelder, who's been on a couple times, and Brooke Husband, and of course Kelly Mason, like all these names, you just keep running into them over and over again. It actually makes me excited about the Ontario wine scene, where you got people that have been around a little bit longer like you guys, and then the younger generation, and seeing them come up. We could wax poetic, but I'll start with you, Dave. Then I want to get your guys' thoughts on the next wine that we're going to try, the 2020 Cabernet Blend. And my first thought is, you would fool the shit out of anyone who doesn't know. There is no green. There's no bell pepper. And for people that like that, I'm sorry. And I just don't. This wine would fool me. There is no way I'm going, you know, I mean, except, I mean, there are a couple of incredible, you know, winemakers in this area that delve in the world of Bordeaux blends. What's the blend on this fella?
This one is, and Peter can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe it's 85% Cab Franc and 15% Merlot.
Okay, so it's a right bank wine. You know, actually, I'll throw it back, Peter, or Ann, if you guys want to take this, and I just talk a little bit just to get the mic over. Just the power of Cab Franc and what it means right now in Ontario.
So Cabernet Franc and the other three varieties that we grow at Dobbin, Chardonnay, Pinot, and Riesling, they're all varieties that have a long track record in the region. So it's no coincidence that because we wanted to do things at a top level, every vintage, we've selected those varieties. Cabernet Franc is interesting in the sense that It's, you know, it's a little more zone specific. Here on the 20 mile bench, it seems to be really well suited as a red. Of course, our harvest dates are going to be much later than perhaps in, you know, some warmer zones, and relative to the other varieties, the Chardonnay and Pinot, but that's also part of the thought process here. What we're looking for, and especially, you know, in the 20 vintage, it was a warm year, so we were actually trying to work with it to make it a little more elegant. So, you know, with our micro vinifications, we were punching them down really gently, you know, manual punch downs and things like that. We even did some fermentation in 500 liter punch-ins where mm-hmm. we removed the heads. And so it's a really small vessel and like intimate contact with the skins, but without actually, you know, aggressively going at the cap. So yeah, I think that's a big part of what made this wine what it is.
Also, and one other question, then we'll put the mics down and try it with the food. 20 must have been harder to obtain elegance, just as you were saying there, because it was a hotter year, and it could be easy to just make a nice big plush wine, which is delightful, but finding elegance, that must have been the hard part of 20, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. That was, you know, every time we'd sit down to taste barrels and talk about blending, it was like, how can we make this Niagara, you know, representative of the 20 mile bench? Because it's so easy to have this wine go over the top in terms of richness and plushness. And so we were, you know, that was just always part of our thought process for the 20 vintage.
All right, let's give it a try. All right, and we are back. Peter, your thoughts on the, again, this is the best breakfast I think I've ever had with the Cabernet, the 2020 Cabernet blend.
Yeah, a really interesting combination. I love what Laura's done with it. Mm-hmm. It's a little more umami, you know, because the we've just recently released the 20. I don't even know that released is the right term, but we've just recently begun pouring the 20. We'd been pouring the 19 prior to that. 19, as you know, a more elegant year, really delicate, less ripeness. So it was a particularly elegant variation on the theme. And so Laura's food with that was, you know, a little more delicate, in line with the wine. This one's a little richer, a little more umami, quite a bit of flavor. I don't even like eggplant, but I love what she's done with it.
You know, it's funny. I'm the same way. I was so excited to do this interview because I was asked this delightful question, which was, do you have any food allergies? I'm like, oh my God, are they going to give me food? This is fantastic. I'm not a big eggplant guy as well. But of course, you're going to eat it. You're in this beautiful room. It was delicious.
Yeah.
If all eggplant was in that form, then it would be nothing but eggplant. We were talking off mic about it, and it's a topic that's been brought up plenty. It's how to get Ontario wine as more part of the conversation, of just the general wine conversation. And this one, there might not be an answer. I wonder what needs to happen. Like, all that we can do on our end is keep telling the stories. But I think eventually it has to trickle down to the somms. It has to trickle down to the wine managers. But then on their part, I also understand they have rent. They got to sell. And maybe it's easier to sell France or Camus than it is Dobbin, than it is Batchelder, than it is on 7, than it is on all these other wines.
I don't know that that's continuing to be the case, so I'm gonna be positive on this one.
Be positive.
We've had some great experience recently. I'll give you an example that I love. Dave's telling me the numbers that are going out to Fairmont. Fairmont's decided that they want to do, it's unusual, a little bit of background. Most wines that you buy by the glass, wineries know that it's sort of $25 a bottle and under retail, because by the time you mark it up with the markups on it necessary at a restaurant to do by the glass, it puts it in a range that's still sort of acceptable to the average person coming in. We, at our price points, when we're up around 70, it's unusual for those to be picked as by the glass wines.
Yeah.
They've nevertheless decided to do it at the Fairmont. They've had a tremendous response. And the reason is, going back to, you know, what you're talking about, is that they're getting people coming in and saying, you know what, I'd really like to try a Canadian wine in that category. I see them continuing to get better and better. And I'm happy now, you know, to spend that money on a Niagara Chardonnay rather than spending it on the, you know, the ones on the list beside it that are from, you know, California, Burgundy, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a really positive thing, and we were delighted to see it.
That Chardonnay is by the glass?
Yes. Absolutely.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I guess if someone's going to buy that by the glass, that's someone who loves wine. And then what you hope for is that they almost become a mini ambassador themselves, and that they talk about it, you know, they talk about it when they go back home.
And it's nice to see that Americans are coming in and doing the same thing, you know. So the response at the Fairmont, which is fairly international clientele, is the same thing. You know, I'm hearing that they're doing some really great things in Niagara, and I want to try that, and I'm happy to spend it. So it's a good thing to see.
Who do you think, and we can throw the mic to whoever, and again, I can always edit out the awkwardness of throwing the mic around. Which country, which region do you think is the most stubborn about wanting to learn new? And I'll give you a couple options. Option one, California. Option two, France. Option three, Southern Ontario. Which one do you think can be the toughest in terms of just opening their minds? Not that they're, you know, there's anything wrong with them, but just opening their minds. Who would like to answer that question of the four of you in this room? Y'all cowards.
I'll take a run at that, just only because it's so typical within the whole evolution of France and the wine and food industry there. I mean, there are whole areas in France where, when especially in the wine regions, where you're only able to get the wines from the area in question. We encounter that in Argentina, for example, and I have a
right.
small vineyard there. To get anything other than Argentine is almost impossible. But if you're in a restaurant in the Rhone, it's very, very likely you're getting a Rhone wine, and your selection of anything else is going to be minimal. So there's no question, I think, in France that not only is there, you know, French identity, but there's really, really strong regional identity. And it's not something we get yet in Niagara. Maybe the mixed ethnicities to a certain extent are our foundation, but we don't get Niagarans only drinking Niagara wine, for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's fundamental in large parts of France.
Nathan, I'm curious for you, just when did you start to fall in love with wine? I've asked this with Peter and Anne. I'd love to ask you and David this.
For me, it was, well, I touched on a little earlier, it was really that Wade took it upon himself to learn about wine, mostly so that he could order wine at business dinners, things like that. It really just trickled down from there to my brother and I. So, I mean, we started drinking good wine. So we were super fortunate in that way. We started drinking good wine right off the bat. We didn't know much about it. Other than that, we were drinking good wine. And, you know, and then in comparison, when you drink a lesser wine, we'll say, you could tell the difference, which is kind of what made exploring Niagara fun and continues to be fun that way, is that going out and trying wines in Niagara and finding those gems. That was really how we started, though. And it was, I always enjoyed wine. I mean, like I said, it was always just part of a way to enjoy life, to have something that you can, something a little bit more complex in your life that you can enjoy while you're, you know, whether it's sitting at the cottage or having a nice dinner. So I enjoyed it at that level. And then once we were involved with this winery, obviously there was a lot more to learn about wine and pay a little bit sharper attention. So I was really just, I always say I'm a wine drinker.
Yeah.
That's what I do. And I enjoy when it's of a quality that, you know, where it's well balanced and complex.
What would you, David?
My mother's always been kind of into wine, so that's kind of the foundation of it. And then I worked in Niagara Falls restaurant industry for about a decade. Kind of always was peripherally around wine, but I kind of decided that it's more of a young man's game, and it's not something I wanted to be into the restaurant industry, I mean, for the majority of my time. I was thinking about going back to school to pursue a winemaking degree, so I decided to kind of step my toe into it by taking WSET level 2 up at Covey. Thoroughly enjoyed that. The instructors were absolutely 10 out of 10. So immediately following that, I signed up to Niagara College, went there, finished that, went back, got my WSET level 3, and just fell in love with the industry. And yeah, I haven't looked back since, and hoping to get my diploma.
It's a lot of work, but I mean, you're making wine, so you know, it's not going to be that difficult. All right, I got to ask you guys, Peter and Ann, you guys were looking over the tech sheets, looking over the reasons. What are you guys yammering about over there?
Actually, we were commenting on the comparison again. Just wanted to taste the new sampling that Laura had done with the Riesling, and yeah, we're really enjoying it.
Let's talk about the reasons. We'll do the food. There's the dry, and then there's just the Riesling, which obviously there'll be, you know, more you know, there'll be a higher amount of sugar in it. I should start here. What's the Riesling program here at Dobbin?
Yeah, good. I'm glad you asked that. So this is a big
one. Hold on. I'm okay. New question. Did you have to fight to really get Riesling to be a big part of the portfolio there.
Well, fight's a little strong.
Convince?
Convince. I think convince is definitely part of it. So Wade wasn't necessarily, he was negative on Riesling, but he was, you know, positive on a lot of other things, like fully understood the importance of the Chardonnay, really wanted to do that, fully understood with the Cabernet Franc, fully understood with the Pinot, there's no question there. And then there was a bit of a question mark on Riesling. So let me give you some background on that. I sort of cut my teeth on, when I first fell in love with wine, it was in university and it was with Riesling. I totally loved Riesling. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was, you know, there was aromas and flavors that just, you know, nothing else in the world had ever presented to me from an organoleptic point of view. So I totally loved it. And I love acidity, you know, so I drink, you know, grapefruit juice in the morning. I love high acid as opposed to lower acid. So I'm really sold on Riesling in that front. And in my early winemaking career, I worked with a company that became purchased by, it's now Trias, but at that time it had been purchased by a German company. And so I spent some time there and at an affiliate company that they owned in Austria, both of which countries, you know, make a fabulous Riesling. One of the things that was really important to that was that I began to realize that on both of, on the best of those properties, the great French and Austrian and German Rieslings were doing 6-7 picks. They weren't doing a single pick. Like, not only can you not machine pick, you can't hand harvest. Like, you really, over a 6 or 7 week period at harvest time, you need to go in and do different picks. You're picking some for acidity very early. By the time the grapes get late and become really exotic or started to be infected with botrytis and get those great apricot sort of tones of that, you're doing individual berry picking in order to be able to get it. So it's a hugely, you know, expensive proposition. And to make the greatest of the Riesling, you've got to just be willing to do all of that tremendous amount of work. And it varies every year. Depends on when the rains are, depends on how sunny it is. It's always different, but there's a huge amount of work in doing Riesling at that top end. But to get the Clos Saint Huns, you know, the $400 right. bottles out of France, those great wines at the very, very top end, very elitist, but at the very, very top end of what's possible, I've always really, really wanted to do that. And Wade and Nathan were both entirely game. We sat down to a tasting of Clos Saint Hun and, you know, the best of, you know, Pichler out of Austria.
Wait. I'm going to stop here. So did you convince Wade and Nathan and the Dobbin estate, did you convince them to do Riesling because you opened up some Saint Hume?
It wasn't just the Saint Hume, it was quite an arsenal, I got to
okay.
say.
But it was, so you plied them with the best, is what you did. Got you drunk. Yeah.
Right.
What a fantastic way to convince. I'm sorry to interrupt. I also need to tell the listeners that when we started, when you said, Peter, I'm glad you asked me about that, Nathan and David over here just lit up, like, and just a knowing look. So I knew that of course, everyone likes Riesling, but sometimes they just need to be swayed a little bit. Just, you know, take them down the lazy river this way of these beautiful wines.
Absolutely. And you know, it's classic. We joke, it's become sort of an in-house story. The very first pick that Wade came down to early in that year was, in fact, a botrytis pick. Mm-hmm. And we'd had three people on the vineyard for a day, and at the end of the day, we had two pails. That was the entire pick.
Yeah.
So Wade's sort of looking around, you know, where are the grapes? And, well, there are these
right there.
Really? You know? And you know what, fabulous flavors, and these incredible berries picked, you know, berry by berry. And so we've begun it. And it was really important to Ann and to me that, you know, to have this opportunity to really try and push the envelope a bit on what we could do with Riesling.
David, I'll throw it to both you guys. Actually, Nathan, you got the mic. I'll start here. How much did you love Riesling in 2018 versus 2024?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I had, you know, to be completely honest, I had no idea of what, I mean, I drink it. But I had no idea of what the possibilities were. And, you know, going back to Peter speaking about the, you know, the convincing us, I had the benefit of being able to go pick. I mean, I don't know if you call it a benefit. I picked them anyways. Huh. Yeah, so, I mean, Garrett's not here with us right now. He's out doing something. Him and I were the ones that went out and did the early picks, like the acidic picks and the botrytis picks and things like that. So for me, it was a little easier to see the vision firsthand of what we were doing and say, okay, I get it. You're basically picking all the ingredients for final blend here. But yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, yeah, I mean, it's a I go to, I taste other Rieslings and say they're pretty good, mm-hmm. but I get what we're doing 100%. And I also get how you can't do that in a $20 bottle or a $30 bottle.
If you're doing multiple picks, that means you're paying multiple human beings to go out there and do that and trying to pay them a fair wage. And that's just one of many parts that goes into these wines.
Oh yeah. And then, you follow through with the micro vinifications and then, everything's being pressed separately. We've got one of the small, I think we're the only one with a small press in a commercial scale that presses, I don't know what it is,
90 liters.
So everything from sorting it, pressing it, then fermenting it separately, and then also the blending's much more laborious too, because you're going through quite a bit more.
Yeah, why make it easy? Why make it easy?
That's it. Well, that's how we get to our Riesling. So,
how different is it, David, helping to make a Chardonnay versus Riesling? I'm just hearing Nathan's answer there from your perspective. Just the difference in the winemaking.
Well, for us, it's actually not that entirely different because we do so many different picks with all of our varietals. Mm. So I'm very used to doing smaller batches and smaller lot Chardonnay pressings and everything like that. So it kind of carries over to the Riesling as well, although not as in depth and thorough. It's a tremendous amount of fun up until you have to clean the press 3, 4, 5 times a day, the tiny little 90 liter basket press. No, but it's absolutely fantastic. And then you just get to see the end result, right? So
yeah,
when you're going through, sure, it's a lot of small fermentations that require a lot of care and considerations when you have these really tiny lots, but it's all worthwhile at the end when you see the net result of it, right?
Peter and Ann, I was wondering if you could take us through the difference between the dry Riesling and just the Riesling, more your classic German style. But you know what? Yeah, I don't want to put generalizations. What are the big difference between the dry and the non-dry?
So I think you've got a bit of a sense of all of the small harvests and ferments that we prepare in the fall. These lots are kept separate. They might be as small as 20 or 50 liters and up to a maximum of 300 liters. And so when we sit down to do the blending, we've got this array of flavors and textures and intensities. Some are higher acid, some are lower, some are mellow and rich. And so it's really a palate in front of us. It's hard not to make two wines out of it, and to be honest, or three. So basically, the final decision on the blends, even though we're doing it as a group, it kind of comes down to Peter's palate. What we wanted to do is to be able to offer something in that crisp yet textural direction, and that's our dry. If you look at the, we've got the text sheet in front of us, and everybody seems to focus on residual sugar in Riesling, but
of course,
in fact, we've got acidity, alcohol, pH, and residual sugar, and I think those are all key elements to what makes the wine not only flavorful, but lingering and lasting on your palate.
That's a good point. We always focus on the sugar. You go on the LCBO website, it'll tell you the grams of sugar per liter of all the wines, from things that are bone dry to Meiomi to everything in the middle. I think it's important for the reasons to tell the story of the wine. It can't just be about the RS. It has to be about everything else. I think it's a good point. I haven't thought of that. Having one number is going to make you focus just on sugar when the story of these wines isn't one statistic.
No, absolutely. And when we move to our Riesling, which is the richer one in the cellar, we tagged it as rich Riesling. And we wanted that richness to come through on the aromas. So that's where you're getting a little more of the influence from, our tiny Botrytis pick, and adding, just that one more dimension to the wine. But when you look at the alcohol, residual sugar, TA, the acidity is higher actually than the dry Riesling. The alcohol is a little bit higher, so that's getting you that breadth on the palate. And the RS is only less than 2 grams per liter higher. So it's really not a sweet Riesling by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
But you've got all of these layers and textures that just you can't forget the wine.
We'll try the food with the wine, and then we'll talk about your complex system of scaring birds away from the vineyards. So I've just tried the two Rieslings, and I want to ask if everyone has one that they like more than the other. Both 2019. I think it's just personal preference. I will say this: when you hear the word dry Riesling, you're thinking like really steely, really linear. But this one is still, there's a lot of richness to this. In fact, I think it could fool people that the dry, you know, maybe isn't as dry as it is. I think for me, I like the Riesling one a little bit more. And you know what? I'll ask you nerdy question. Is there anything different when you're collecting, when you're picking for botrytis affected grapes? How different is that than just say your normal Chardonnay grapes?
So with the Riesling, when we were growing them organically, I've found over the years that that botrytis expresses very classically. So when there's synthetic fungicides, you get all kinds of disgusting rot when the grapes break down. And that's just, you know, being purely honest. And,
yeah.
They're VA and they're garbage, right? Whereas with classic botrytis, you're getting that dehydration. So, you know, we've watched, you know, with Dave out there walking the rows, and you see them starting to turn color. So the green color starts to fade and they're starting to go in a gray-blue direction. And then the mold forms, you know, it's, you know, if it was in your refrigerator on, you know, on some hot dogs or something, you'd be disgusted. But the fact that furry blue-gray is what we're looking for in the botrytis-affected berries. It doesn't happen on the whole cluster immediately, and the weather conditions are a big factor on that. And really what we want is humidity and maybe a bit of dew in the morning and then drying off by noon in order to get really good botrytis. But also, we don't want 100% botrytis. We're not making sweet wines. We're
right.
Going to that level of concentration. And so we're actually going out there, and our pickers are, you know, manually picking. We're instructing them what you'd normally cut out and drop on the ground for all the other vineyards you go to. That's what we're putting into the box today, mm-hmm. Right? And so, you know, it takes some oversight and some care, but that's really how we're doing it, is just you go out there into the clusters and you're taking off a piece of the cluster or a few berries from the cluster and putting that into the box.
So when I look on the text sheet, and I think for people who don't know, usually you would assume the wine that can be aged the longest has got to be the red wine. And my God, it's a Cab Franc, Merlot, Bordeaux. You can throw that away forever. And if I look on the text sheet, the wine that you have, and again, everything's, you know, not 100%, but the wine that can be cellared the longest is your 2019 botrytis affected Riesling. What is it about the Riesling that you have it as that one has the potential for the longest cellaring of the four wonderful wines we've tried today?
No, I think that's it's a universal thing within the context of greatly made Riesling that they age extremely well. And I mentioned some examples earlier in the Austrian Fekau and in the great regions in Germany and in the best in Alsace. That longevity's there, and it's a factor. I mean, it's high acid. Acid preserves the wine. There's little bits of sweetness, you know, residual sugars left over from the berries that also act as a bit of preservative. But they just age extremely well. I mean, they're almost without surprise. I mean, in our cellar, there's a large percentage of Riesling at home. And in our love 20-year-old Rieslings. And mm-hmm. They're so reliable. I mean, like, you bring it up, it's in great health. I mean, they really just show well, and even for longer than that. So
let's get to the one thing I found of interest was high-tech bird distraction devices that may or may not involve lasers. Who is, and yes, I'm, I was going to do, yeah, the Mike Myers ride. Are they at least ill-tempered? Who can talk about these lasers, bird distracting devices that are around the vineyard here?
Yeah, so I'm happy to describe how they work,
yeah.
But also the main viticultural reason to use them, and we're trying them in a few different ways. just to figure out, you know, how they're the most effective. But our main goal is to not net the vines. So
okay.
With our tight spacing, our, you know, Chardonnay Pinot particularly, we're already limiting airflow, the natural airflow, by having the tight spacing and working with varieties that are sensitive to moisture. So with netting, you're kind of mashing all the leaves into a tight space. And so they don't function the way they normally would in terms of flapping in the breeze or turning to face the sun as the day progresses. So we want to, you know, eliminate that that component that's, you know, kind of interfering with how the vines normally would function in the fall. And then in addition to that, we don't want the birds to come and eat our precious harvest. So the bird lasers, it's a green light. We don't see it as humans, especially during the day. We'll see it at night, or we'll see it up against a wall or something like that. But the birds see it as motion. And, you know, like you see the ribbons that people use in to deter birds, it's the motion that the birds are responding to. So they don't like the motion. It's not something that they can sort of feel comfortable to land on, and so they just move along. And that's what the lasers do. It's they see it as something coming towards them, and they just move away. So it's not distressing them like those bird,
the cannons.
The cannons distress the people that have,
yeah, that's true.
But also there's distress calls for birds where it sounds right. Like, you know, there's a hawk choking at some tiny little bird,
right? You can get that on your phone on YouTube to scare a crow to the top of a tree. Those don't work, by the way. I can tell you, those do not work.
Well, they're used in vineyards a lot as well. So what we're trying to do is, you know, get rid of those stressful things, but we don't want flocks of starlings coming and destroying our crop.
I'll do one more just round of questions for all of you. David, I'll start with you. People can't see this, but in the room, from David to Nathan to Ann to Peter. What are you, just as assistant winemaker and been coming here and working before at Kay Luce and been around like so many really just smart people, what excites you about being here for the next couple of years?
First and foremost, it's the process that we do here. Everything is done with purpose, as you can tell based on the interview going or so far. The attention to detail and everything like that is really cool. It's really fun, and it leads to the ability to make solid wines that, like Peter said, that are going to continue to age for hopefully long after I'm here. It's just the property itself as a whole, and I would love all your listeners to come out here and actually see what the property entails, because over the radio or podcast doesn't really do it justice. It's a little oasis, and that's what Wade wanted to create when he bought the place, is just a place for people to kind of come and just kind of forget everything, enjoy nature, enjoy wine, enjoy your friends, your company, everything like that. I think that's the coolest thing about here is just the ambiance overall.
Is there where's the best place for people to find this? Is there a website? Where would people go if they want to learn more about this winery and how to come by? And Oasis is the perfect way to describe this place.
Yeah, absolutely. It's DobbinEstate.com. Mm-hmm. And you can book tastings for private tastings for groups of up to 10 people. We're starting a patio tasting where you can do it in groups of four starting beginning of May. And everything's available on there to book your times. So please come and join us here.
Nathan, I saw this quote here from Anne, and she said that this is Wade's love letter to Niagara. I was wondering your thoughts on that statement. I think Anne was being interviewed by Rick Van Sickle and said, this is all a love letter to Niagara. What does that mean?
Like I said, we grew up here, and it's our chance to, I mean, growing up here, we had the opportunity to explore Niagara every day of our childhood. So, you know, whether that meant going down to the gorge, whether it meant going to Dufferin Islands, whether it meant going through Short Hills here on the Escarpment or the Bruce Trail, we're immensely proud of what Niagara has to offer. You know, if it was eating, you know, Niagara fruits and vegetables on our plates as kids, it's just such a phenomenal place in general to be able to grow up as children. So to be able to contribute back and have something, I mean, I said earlier I'm a wine drinker and I was kind of joking, but I mean, the thing is, Ann, Peter, Dave, they're all winemakers. And for me, the thing is that it's creating something that can create a happiness for people, Whereas, you know, sometimes wine can be a little intimidating when you get into the specs of wine and what are you tasting and what are you smelling. And I think what our love letter to Niagara also is creating something that someone that's not necessarily versed in wine can understand the quality of and enjoy. Mm-hmm. In our bottle, if you put it on your table, you don't have to be somebody that's, you know, you got a W set or somebody that's spent their life studying wine to know that this is a quality wine and something that you can just take pleasure in. And that kind of goes with the property as well. So all of that is trying to give something to anyone that loves that sort of thing an opportunity to enjoy it.
Here's the best analogy I'll give with these wines, just to add to your point, is that you don't need to be an expert and do the quartermaster and do the W set. You may not know much about music, but if you're in a room with an opera singer and they start singing, your whole body, I've had this happen, your whole body will shake because of their ability and their skill and the power. And you're just like, holy shit, what's going on? And I think anyone who's just getting into wine, they'll try these wines and I think where they're going to feel it, some a little bit more on the nose, all of them on the mid palate, where there is balance, there is structure. These are beautiful wines. And every time, and it's funny, I feel bad. Like sometimes I think I need to shit on a wine here or there because I'm always gushing, but I usually choose very carefully the places I go and interview. I mean, Christ, it feels like half the places I go to, Peter and Anna are a part of, but I'm getting less and less shocked by the quality of wines throughout Niagara, whether it's in the Bench where it's closer to the falls, no matter where it is, there's always really, really good wine. I'll end with this with you guys, because I've asked you so many questions. So I'll try to go in a bit of a different direction. Do you guys feel pressure? Because there's a handful of people I feel that are on the tip of the spear of representing the best of what Ontario can do. You guys are there. I can't go anywhere without, seeing about, you got to check out this winery. Oh, okay, I'll go to that winery. Who's in charge? Oh, well, they hired Peter and Ann or are doing some consulting. And it's incredible. Like the Daubenere, these are fantastic wines. Do you guys feel any pressure just being the tip of the spear of sending the message of what premium wine in this area can be?
Each project that we've taken on or been involved in gives us inspiration. And I think, Peter can talk about that more from the direction of the people. For me, it comes from the vineyards. What I, love and what I love about Daubin here is the site. It's not just the natural beauty and, being able to walk around and see all the bird life around the pond and that sort of thing. I'm looking at it from the potential of the soil for vineyards. The site, the aspect, the soils, the climate, bringing all that together. And we were just talking about this a couple of days ago, where it's like, with the wine, we're thinking vintage to vintage. We're so in the moment during the growing season and into the harvest that there is some pressure. We've got to have great fruit from this vineyard. When it comes to the kind of looking at an individual project, what I'm trying to do is think, I gotta plan out and think and execute on a vineyard for 40 years from now. It's like, what do we know now? What did we learn, in the last 20 or 30 years? And how can we apply that to where we see not just trends in the market, but where's the climate going? And, what do we want to accomplish, in terms of that lasting vineyard footprint in the region?
Peter, last word to you.
Pressure. It's an interesting question. Can't say I've encountered it, but...
Good, because I always like to try to ask someone one question they haven't been asked before.
Yeah, so it's... pressure is... It's a privilege, and it's an opportunity, and it's a challenge. So, the excitement comes with that. And it's very much the way we look at the project. This one had a really interesting opportunity to try and do something with Riesling. Can we get it to the... where we want to get it? We'll find out. And is there pressure in that? Sure. But the privilege and the opportunity and the challenge far exceed that weight.
These are fantastic wines. Guys, thank you so much for letting me peek behind the curtain here at Daubin Estate and trying the Chard and the Right Bank Bordeaux blend and the dry and the classic Riesling. These have been great wines. And thank you so much for people behind the scenes with the food pairing. It's been fantastic. And for me, every opportunity to get exposed to just different expressions of the wines that are made throughout Niagara, throughout Ontario, is always great. So everyone, thank you so much for being a part of this. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.